Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. If you have not been with us before, this is Central Coast Voices, and we address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes and transitions in our society. Our goal is to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of the community, generally local members of the community. Oftentimes, though, it's out-of-area guests that may be here for other topics. And we're glad you're part of the discussion today. We're going to talk about wildlife issues in a minute, but I wanted to go over a couple of other things with you real quick. This is a project of Action for Healthy Communities. Action for Healthy Communities is a subgroup out of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, and we put out a report every 3 years called Vital Signs. It's a snapshot of where the community is, where people are with regard to the economy, their education, the education of their families, health and safety issues. And that report is available for review and or download at actionslo.org. That's just simply actionslo, as in San Luis Obispo.org. It's a report that is free and available to you, both the current one, which most recently came out in December of 2013, and the previous reports that came out in three-year cycles before that are available for you to compare what things are going on in the community. It's a lot of what we look at when we look at what the community is seeing as important factors to deal with. One of the things that we all probably often think about but don't know what the focus is what happens when we live in a community like this that's very close to nature. I was driving home yesterday evening on a road in the middle of Atascadero, actually in the city, populated, and I had to slow down for, I think I counted 12 deer that decided that I wasn't a threat to them, so they were just going to kind of hang out in the middle of the street, which was surprising. So we're dealing with wildlife around us all the time, as is Pacific Wildlife Care. And they're here and part of helping our wild neighbors. And I have today with me two representatives from Pacific Wildlife Care, Claudia Duxworth and Virginia Flaherty. And they're going to talk with us today about really what's gone on in the community as far as wildlife recently and what we need to pay attention to and think about. We're all aware of, hopefully, the Gaviota oil spill that happened last year in Santa Barbara County, and how that's affected wildlife and how they've worked with a sister organization out of Santa Barbara to address some of those concerns. And we really don't know what happens when there are sick sea otters found, or when there's a lot of birds that we don't know quite why they're not doing as well as we think they should be. And Pacific Wildlife Care really is the primary care source in San Luis Obispo County for these issues. And today Claudia and Virginia are going to talk to us about that topic, because we may think we know about all the animals around us and why they're there and what they're doing, but that may not necessarily have been the case. Pacific Wildlife Care has been around, I believe, for about 30 years. And why don't we start with a little bit of history of the organization? So which one of you would like to maybe tell us the origin and history of Pacific Wildlife Care?
Well, I'll make a start at it. Okay. This is Claudia. Okay. First, I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about Pacific Wildlife Care. It was founded in 1986 when there was an oil spill. It was the Apex Houston tanker that spilled oil north of us, and oiled pelicans were washing up at Avila Beach. And some people found them and didn't know what to do. And as a result of that, decided that we needed to learn about how we can help these animals when that happens. So they started trying to learn about how to care for oiled animals. And there was very little information back in 1986. But we formed a nonprofit and rehabbed out of our homes for a number of years. And then in 2007, thanks to some circumstances, the Guadalupe oil spill required mitigation. We received some funding from that and from the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, which is a state agency, and we're able to build a center in Morro Bay, and we opened it in 2007. And since that time, we have grown. We've become more widely known because of the internet. People can look us up. And we, in 2012, we hired a full-time wildlife veterinarian. And just recently, we have hired a center director. And we're mostly volunteer-based, but we have some paid staff just because of the required hours. We're open 365 days a year and receive animals every day.
Yeah. Before we proceed any further, I want to remind folks that this is a call-in program. The phone number is 781-3875. You're welcome to be part of this discussion. It may be a question. It may be some experiences that that you've had with the center, or with some experiences you've had with dealing with wildlife issues. So please give us a call. The guests are really willing to and interested in having you as part of the discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. And that's a key factor in how we proceed with the program. We'd like you to have an opportunity to make sure the things that you're interested in get addressed if we're not addressing them directly. Virginia, the perception is that, you know, we all see animals that are somewhat injured. Sometimes we see a squirrel that's not doing well. We see a possum in the middle of the road. We see and I don't know, we see birds that we thought would have been really healthy, but they're not doing real well. And I think the general perception among those of us who are not in your field is that, no, this is just a part of nature, and there's nothing we can do and nothing that can be done. Obviously, organizations like yours feel like there's other things that can be done. How many animals on a monthly or annual basis do you end up dealing with at the center?
Last year was our biggest year, 2015. We had almost 3,000 animals last year. And this year already we have almost 400. It's only not even the end of February yet. And going back to your original statement or observation about seeing animals that aren't doing well, I think for us, we feel that a lot of things that happen to animals have happened as a result of interaction in some way with humans. And so it's important to us to try to give something back to wildlife and to nature, and to try to help animals that have, for instance, a red-tailed hawk we got in a couple days ago was hit by a car on the side of the road, and somebody like you saw it there, and actually the hawk was injured enough that they could pick it up and bring it in, and that hawk was released about a week later. So it's great for us to be able to get those animals back out into the wild after something like that has happened to it. And as Claudia said, we get in animals every single day. Sometimes it's one or two, and sometimes it's 20, 25. And right now we're quite up this year in numbers over last year already.
So you're dealing mostly with animals that have been harmed or intruded upon by Homo sapiens. Or is that what we can assume?
Many, the majority, yes. We get a lot of seabirds that are tangled in fishing line. We get a lot of songbirds that have been caught by cats. We get possums that have been caught by dogs. We have animals that are orphaned because the parent has been trapped and moved somewhere else. We have them hit our windows, hit them in our cars. People put out poison for a rodent, which then goes out into the wild and is eaten by a hawk. So, yeah, a lot of what we get is as a result of that. And then, as you mentioned before, a lot of things we get in, we really don't know why they're coming in. Last year we had a crisis with hundreds of common murres, which is a pelagic seabird, coming in. And they were all starving, but we really didn't know why.
Back up and define that for me, please.
The bird is called a common murre.
Okay.
And it's a pelagic bird. Pelagic means it lives its life entirely on the water, out in the open ocean. So those birds aren't land birds. They're bird. A good example would be a common loon. That bird lives its entire life on the water. Okay. And so sometimes we just don't know why they're coming in. They're starving. Is it something that's going on with their food source in the open oceans? It's a big question mark sometimes.
Yeah. When we, as most of our listeners know, we send out a questionnaire and for a dialogue for information we may not know about any organization. And one of the key questions on that is, what are misconceptions about what you do or what is involved in this case? There were two that really jumped out at me that that people may not think about, and that is that we poison certain things in our environment and how those affect wild animals. So if I'm putting out poison for squirrels, that's affecting things other than squirrels, I guess. And
right,
can we address how that is something we need to pay better attention to?
I think a lot of take a squirrel or a rat or a mouse or something like that. If you put out poison, most of the poisons that are out there don't kill that animal right away. So the animal is sick. It doesn't usually die, you know, underneath your house or somewhere, although it might. But it'll go out into the wild and is slow and sick and easy to catch. And so we see a lot of hawks and owls and occasionally bobcats that have ingested a poisoned mouse or rat. It was easy for them to catch. They got it, and now they've been poisoned as well along with it. So that's pretty common. We also we do get in lead-poisoned birds as well, mostly turkey vultures, also some hawks. And this is an issue with California condors as well. And I think what happens a lot of times is that people, they're shooting ground squirrels because they're a pest on their property, but not removing that bird from the environment. And so a turkey vulture will come down, not removing that squirrel. And the turkey vulture will come down and eat because they're carrion eaters. They'll eat that squirrel and then ingest the lead, and then they become very sick from that. So that's another poisoning that happens to these guys.
So that's something that you have as kind of a battle all the time. You're dealing with animals that you had not counted on. You had not counted on dealing with this particular owl that was healthy until it ate a tainted squirrel, I guess.
Right.
The good news is, as far as lead poisoning, is California is taking the lead in getting lead out of the environment, largely because of the condor issue. But legislation was passed in 2013, and they're going to phase out lead by 2019. You will not be able to use lead at all in any bullets in California. We've seen countless vultures, and golden eagles are the other bird that gets lead poisoning. It's very sad, and it's very difficult to treat.
Yeah. You also mentioned that people have a misconception that using their cats as rodent and bird control is seen as a natural transition, but you guys have some concerns about that, I guess.
We do. Cats are not they're not native. They're an introduced species. They're exotic. So the wildlife in California has not evolved to have defenses against cats. Cats are often well-fed, and animals are out there struggling to survive for their food. So it's an unfair competition. Additionally, most of us are animal lovers in general. Most of us have cats. We love cats. And if you talk to vets will tell you that indoor cats live healthier, longer lives than outdoor cats. Outdoor cats are hit by cars, they're caught by coyotes, they get into poisons, they get diseases and parasites, they do much better indoors. And I know there are people who believe that a cat needs to be outside to lead a healthy life, but a vet will tell you that's not the case. So we really, the Audubon Society has done a study on the number of songbirds that are killed by cats, and it's enormous. It's in the billions. So we just try to encourage people who love cats and love wildlife to keep their cats indoors, and it's a win-win for the cat owner, and for our wildlife.
Okay. How do you receive most of your, I guess, first contact? I would assume you don't have a patrol that goes out looking for endangered or injured wildlife.
Right.
So take me through a day of what happens when a new animal is introduced to your center and how it got there in the first place.
Almost all of the animals are brought in by the public, and either brought in by them, they are walking on the beach and they find something on the beach, pick it up and bring it into our center. A lot of people know where we are now. And the other way that they come to us is we have a hotline, 543-WILD, and we get a lot of calls on the hotline. People will say, I have a great horned owl that has a broken wing, and as Claudia and I both know, that's not something you necessarily want to approach on your own. And they'll call in and leave a message on our hotline. We have regular phone volunteers who check the phone lines regularly, and they'll call you back and find out what the situation is. And then if it sounds like it's something that we can get and we have a transporter, we have a whole group of volunteer transporters who'll come out and get that animal and bring it into the center. So those are the two main ways that they come into us. And then once it gets there, it goes through a whole intake program. It's looked at either by the veterinarian, our wildlife veterinarian, or one of our rehab technicians, and they do a full exam of the animal and a blood draw, and then determine what the protocol is going to be and how long, you know, what the animal needs as far as medications and wound care and things like that. And then it's at our center until it's hopefully ready to be released. Ultimately, that's our main goal.
There are people who, I guess, perceive that what you do may not be responsive enough, for lack of a better way of putting it. It's why can't you help every animal? Why are there animals that don't get helped soon enough? From what you've said, you're primarily a volunteer organization, so I'm wondering how you address those kind of concerns.
We can only treat the animals that we're aware of. We really have to have we rely on the public to find these injured animals and bring them to us. People think that we're often think that we're a government agency. We get calls where people say there's a dead animal in the road. You know, will you come and pick it up? But we can't go out and patrol, as you said earlier, and find these animals. We really have to count on people who are out there and bringing them to us. So we're very grateful to the public who does call in about these animals and who cares enough when they find an injured animal to contact us so we can help them.
Yeah. So there are some people who think you're county animal control.
Right. Or that we are a government agency and don't realize that we're all volunteers, we're a nonprofit, we rely on memberships and donations and grants to do the work we do.
Mm-hmm. And people to be there to answer the phones and to come out to different properties and different places. If you think about the county, how large our county is, and sometimes I'll get phone calls from the different hotline people who say, I've got a call from somebody who lives in Paso Robles and this is the situation. Well, you know, we all have jobs and children and things like that that we have as well, and that person can't always find somebody to get out there necessarily. And okay. We do our best, I have to say. We all work very hard.
Yeah, and we have a caller. Let me go. Okay. Susan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm
okay,
here.
So you have a question about outdoor cats?
I don't have a question, but I just want to say that Pacific Wildlife Care is a wonderful organization doing great things. But to suggest that all cats should live a life indoors is a real disservice to cats. They're predators. They eat birds. Lots of cats will not stay inside no matter what. They will find a way out, or they will whine at the door for 10 years. But many cats will not stay in, and there's no way of keeping them in. And it's because they need to have their feet on the earth. They need to experience bugs and trees. Otherwise, it's like keeping a 3-year-old kid in one room all their life. It's just unfair to suggest such a thing because of birds, you know.
Susan, this is Virginia. I have a cat. He's actually an outdoor cat. He came that way, so to speak, from animal services. He was an older cat, and he's used to being out. I have kids going in and out of the house, mm-hmm. dogs going in and out of the house. He's an outdoor cat. What I have done with him is put one of these crazy-looking collars on him. I call it a clown collar. He looks like a clown. It's brightly colored and ruffled, and I put it on him every morning when he goes out, and the birds actually see that. Mm-hmm. Bells don't work on birds or on cats to deter birds. This collar seems to have done an amazing trick for him. He's mm-hmm. not caught anything. He's been living outside now for probably 7 years. So there are other alternatives out there if your cat's an outside cat.
You know, a lot of cats love their selves as hunters. You know, I'm an animal communicator, so I can feel what the cat feels. And some are very, very proud of themselves as great hunters.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call, Susan, and we can explore that a little further. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, it's... It you know, everybody has a different feel for how their animal and animals fit into their environment. I have 2 acres and my dogs want to be outdoor dogs all the time, but we've discovered that they've figured out how to dig further outdoors than we can prevent, so they become kind of indoor dogs. It's a tug of war.
Yes,
I'm
it
sure,
is.
I'm sure it's a tug of war that you address in a lot of ways all the time.
Yeah, and we're just asking people to consider if they have a cat now that's outdoors, it may be too difficult to bring it in. But in the future, if they consider when they get a cat, a lot of cats can do very well indoors, and just to consider it and consider the effect that it has on our wildlife.
Yeah. Here's maybe the flip side question to that from my perspective, and that is there are people who believe that wild animals make great domestic pets, and I'm wondering how you address that, and if that's something that comes up all the time.
Well, first of all, in California, it's illegal to have wild animals as pets. It's actually against the law. If you find a wild animal, you're supposed to turn it over to a wildlife rehabilitator within 48 hours. And wild animals really don't make good pets. One thing that we try to emphasize is that you have to know the natural history of a wild animal. You have to know the kind of diet it requires, the kind of caging it requires. You can run into all kinds of problems trying to keep a wild animal in captivity. And well-meaning people who love animals have done it and have ended up causing tremendous harm. So we make a point of learning about these animals. We study them. We attend conferences so that we know what their nutritional needs are, their caging needs are, and our goal is to get the animal back out into the wild. So we would discourage people from making wild animals as pets.
It's very common to get a very cute baby raccoon or squirrel or something like that. They're very cute when they're little, but let me tell you, when they get older, not so cute, not something you necessarily want to have around your house.
Yeah, let's visit that in a minute. We've got a call from Roger, and I want to give him a chance to get into the discussion here. Roger, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Oh, I agree that it's good to get the animal back out into the wild where the animal belongs, but here in Cambria, the Cambria Community Services District and the State Cal Fire are systematically eradicating the wild, systematically eradicating the little remnants of the once vast Monterey pine tree temperate rain, mist, and fog forest. Cambria's one of the few remaining places where it's left. But with the land clearing campaign, the cutting of the Monterey pine trees, and the weed whacking of the understory, ripping it out by the roots, I mean, tossing the topsoil up into the air and choking clouds of dirt and dust every spring as a government mandate. And any homeowner who doesn't do that, any landowner that doesn't do that, is subject to a criminal fine without trial. It's eradicating, and I have watched firsthand the beautiful fox families, these gorgeous rust-colored foxes. I think they're called gray foxes, but they're gorgeous. Quail families, deer families, raccoon families. I've watched them with eradication of probably 6 dozen Monterey pine trees in one area here, where I'm familiar with, being eliminated. I called Art Trinidad, the head of the county code enforcement, out once, and Cal Fire, to look at how the lush green living landscape was being transformed into a torn, tinder dry desert deathscape in the name of wildfire control. It's actually doing.
Roger, I want to interject for a second because I want to double check with my guests. I think you may be getting into an area of zoning advocacy that may be outside of their purview. So hold on a second.
Habitat is a huge issue, and there are organizations like the Nature Conservancy and Audubon that make that their issue. For it, it, as much as we're concerned about it, it's not our primary goal.
Yeah, and Roger, so maybe this is a topic that we want to have other guests in to address in the future. So I thank you for your call. Okay, let's go. While we've got a lot of calls here, so I want to make sure we don't leave anybody on hold for too long. So let's see, Paul, are you there?
I am.
Okay, what you have some questions about owls and dogs?
Yeah, I live. My wife and I live up in Paso Robles, and we have a beautiful house with a couple of blue oaks that sort of in the backyard, and the backyard's open to the dogs when we let them out. I only go out there when they're supervised. One of the dogs is about 20 pounds, and the other one is about 10. She's a little schnauzer, and she's pretty small. And I'm always concerned that she's just too small and too tempting for, like, a hawk or an owl or something like that. And I wanted to get your opinion about that. Most of the backyard is shaded from the trees, but there are some areas where, you know, how do they need just open space to dive bomb, or where they come around a tree?
Yeah.
I don't know this.
Yeah.
I have
Virginia's
that concern.
Got an observation.
I have a 5.5-pound dog, and I live, I back up onto open space as well with hawks and owls. Unless the dogs are out at night, I wouldn't worry about the owls. They're just going to be hunting at night. A 5-pound dog like my dog, I would be concerned about a hawk or something picking her up. And I have a friend who had a golden eagle pick up a 20-pound dog, but didn't get very far with it.
So I
would say, yeah, I'd keep an eye on that for sure. I think about that.
Okay.
Wow, that's interesting.
Okay.
20 pounder. Wow.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's see. And we've got people are asking some interesting questions. So we have Jeremy's got some questions about feeding birds. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys have an official policy or just thoughts about the feeding of wild birds. If I'm doing a disservice to them, I don't have bird feeders or anything, but I keep peanuts on my person to give to the blue jays. And am I doing them a disservice by doing that?
You know, generally, and Fish and Wildlife, their policy is certainly not to feed wildlife. And we don't encourage people to feed wildlife. I think most of us put out feeders for birds, which is another issue with cats. If you have cats and you're bringing birds into your yard, you might want to think about that. But I think it's generally not. I think scrub jays love their peanuts, and they can get almost tame coming into peanuts. You always have to be aware, are you bringing them into a dangerous area? I think the problem arises if you're bringing in large numbers of animals. There are people who feed raccoons, for example, and they'll bring in, you know, they'll have 5-10 raccoons feeding off of cat food in their yards. And the problem is disease, because animals generally don't congregate together like that. So if you're bringing in large numbers of animals congregating together, you can spread disease. And we've seen it happen with pigeons and finches, where there'll be one bird that's diseased and it spreads throughout the flock. So it's something to at least be aware of, and maybe take your feeders down at certain times of the year.
Okay, as I said, I don't have feeders. I just keep a couple peanuts in my backpack, and walking back and forth from the bus stop and home, I've got a certain blue jay that pops up, not even every day, not in the same spot. So I don't think I'm...
No, I don't.
Got you marked.
I think you're okay. I don't think that's. I don't think
that's population in general.
That's harmful at all.
Okay.
It just, yeah.
Okay. So continue to enjoy it, Jeremy.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. And that probably brings up an interesting question, because my wife has bird feeders out in the front yard that are basically just putting out a selection of seeds. They're basically seeds that she buys in a large bag, sometimes a rather large bag. They would be the kind of thing I would assume that the birds, if they could find an adequate supply of them naturally, would eat anyway. So it's not like feeding them dog food.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a concern?
You know, I don't
think so. No, I think that Claudia's point of keeping the feeders clean is really critical.
Mm-hmm.
If they get moldy and if a bird comes on that has a disease, it'll get spread pretty quickly. So keeping them clean and bringing them in and bleaching them actually on a regular basis is a very good idea. And then, you know, a place like Wild Birds Unlimited, they can talk to you about different types of seeds that we have here and what you can put out. And, you know, my neighbor planted pyracantha berries, and he gets cedar waxwings, and so he brings them in using that. So, yeah, that I think that that's...
So that's actually bringing in a natural, reasonably indigenous plant.
It's a landscape plant that he's got in his backyard that's not spreading anywhere. It's just... providing berries for a bird that lives here and migrates through the area. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and I think that's ideal if you can plant native plants that the birds eat anyway, and not to overdo it. We had a neighbor who was filling multiple bird feeders and overfilling them, and they started drawing rats because the feed was falling on them.
Yeah.
So you just have to be aware that you can have unintended consequences. And also, if you see sick birds around your feeder, you really do need to take them down and clean them so it doesn't spread.
We I think a lot of us have an impression. I talked to some other folks and asked this question too, that if a baby bird falls out of a nest, that if I touch the baby bird and try and put it back in the nest, it's doomed to death, if you will.
That is not true.
It's a very harmful myth.
Yes.
Okay. And so, indeed, the first effort is to try and put anything that's an injured animal or fallen animal back in its natural spot.
That's a good question for the hotline. You could call and say, I found a baby bird, and they'll ask you questions. Does it have feathers? Can you see the nest? To try to get an idea, is this just a baby that's fallen out of the nest and maybe you can reach back and put it back in, and is the mother coming around still? We also have a re-nesting program, so if it's a hawk or an owl or something like that and you find it on the ground, usually that will come into our center and we'll check to make sure it didn't break a wing or a leg or some injury happened to it when it fell out of the nest. And if everything looks good, then we have somebody who will go out and re-nest that bird back either in the original nest, or if that's blown down, they will reconstruct a nest sometimes out of a laundry basket or whatever works and put it back up into the tree. And then with the person who called that bird in, our volunteer will observe the nest over several days to make sure the mother's coming back and feeding it. So, and we're very successful with that. So it just depends on the situation, what type of bird and what the situation is.
Because I think there's a perception for a lot of us who are not in the field that you're in that most of the animals that you rescue are doomed to, if they survive at all, to survive in captivity because you can't release them back in the wild. I guess a baby that's nursed because its parent its mother bird has died or has gone away, or a sea otter that's a baby that has a mother that's been lost, that there's no way that animal's going to make it back in the wild once they're healthy. And I guess that's another myth.
Yeah, we're coming up on baby season, and we get many, many calls of birds on the ground that people think need to be helped, and in a lot of cases they don't. Birds go through a stage called fledging, where they come out of the nest, they're fully feathered, but they can't yet fly, and it takes them about 3 or 4 days to begin to fly well enough. In the meantime, the parents are taking care of those birds, they're feeding them, they're watching them. So in that case, if it's an uninjured fledgling, we would encourage people to leave the bird alone, keep your pets indoors, and give the bird a chance to start to fly. A nestling bird is a bird that doesn't have its feathers yet and has come out of the nest, and that's a little different because that bird, we would like to try to get it back in the nest, but we have to be sure that the parents are around and are still feeding the bird. So oftentimes we'll say, bring the bird into our center, we'll look it over, we'll make sure it's healthy, and then we'll either have them put it back or we'll put it back, and as Virginia said, we'll observe to make sure that the parent is continuing to care for the bird. But it's a complete myth. We've actually taken a bird in, put it on antibiotics for 7 days, and put it back in the nest, and the parents are still there and still caring for it. So they're very
interesting. Okay,
dedicated parents.
And just also back to your point about if we do end up taking care of that baby, is it doomed? And no, the answer is no. Ideally, it would be with its parent. But we have raised untold numbers of baby birds and mammals and release them successfully into the wild. Mm-hmm. So that's just not the ideal situation. But if the parents have been killed or are not coming back around, then we will raise that bird or mammal.
I want to revisit that, but I don't want Paris to have to sit on the line for too long. So we have a question about bird seed. By the way, if you want to call in, we still have some time left. We'd be glad to take your calls. We're getting some interesting Q&A here. The phone number is 781-3875. This is Public Radio KCBX, and you're part of our community, and we want you to be part of the discussion. So the phone number is 781-3875. Paris, are you there?
Yeah. Let's see. I've got a pretty nice little piece of property here that has plenty of natural flowering and seeding kind of plants. So I don't put bird feed out or anything, but I've got neighbors that love to do that. And I'm wondering if I've got stinging nettles propping up the last 5-6 years all of a sudden all over the place and morning glory if it's in the bird seed. And at the same time, I've got people complaining that they have rats. I know rats and mice love bird seed, and so I'm trying to discourage people from getting wild cats to eat them because, you know, I said get rat zappers. But I also heard that if you nuke the bird seed for a minute, it kind of kills the germinating process. At least your seeds aren't that spill over aren't producing or that are dropped out of droppings able to germinate. Is that true?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either, but I would be very, very, I would not think that they would have stinging nettles in wild bird seed. I think
the finches love stinging nettles, so.
Right. Well, I think what, I know what's happened in my yard is that I've got poison oak in my yard because the towhees eat the poison oak and then they disperse it into my yard. So that may be what's happening, that they're getting it from actual stinging nettle plants and not necessarily from the bird seed. But I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And Wild Birds Unlimited may be able to answer that for you.
Yeah. And then if you could recommend that people buy rat zappers rather than cats or poison. Poison's the most horrible thing.
Yes, we are on board with that. In fact, we have the occasional rat problem at our wildlife center, and that's what we use.
Yeah, and they're amazing.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Paris.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for your calling in. Appreciate it.
Bye. Okay, bye.
Okay, let's go. Okay, Wayne, you're here. Jump on in.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the indoor cats. We say that it'd be better to keep cats indoors. But cats have been with us for at least, I'd say, California, 100 years. I know they're not a native species, but if we were to keep them all indoors, I mean, when did they become a part of the ecosystem? I mean, would they be overrun with rats and mice and things like that if everybody kept their cat indoors?
Well, I think this is an issue that probably is not going to be resolved on this show, but there are natural predators for rats and mice, coyotes, all of our hawks.
Bobcats.
Bobcats eat mice and rats, eat rodents. I think the issue as far as the indoor cats are is that the evidence is, and there's very good evidence, that they're killing off large numbers of our songbirds, and our songbirds are declining. And so there's real concern about that, and the difference with a wild animal, a natural predator, is that they aren't fed and cared for the way our cats are. So they are having to compete with other wildlife to survive and for their food. And so that gives the cats, our pet cats, a real advantage. And I'm not the one saying that cats do better indoors. It's what veterinarians say about cats. So I don't think we're going to solve this particular issue here today, and people will continue to have pretty strong opinions about it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the discussion. Okay. Okay. Let's see. We've had a couple other calls here, so let me see which. Okay. Is it Silas?
Yes.
Hi, Silas. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I'd like to start by saying I fully support what your people are doing in regards to animals. I'm very passionate about them myself. I live on the Central Coast, and I'm often at the beach, and I see how many animals, including some of the birds you said spend their life on the ocean, they're washing up emaciated and empty stomachs. And I'm wondering, you guys said you do tests on the animals, like blood tests. Do you test for any kind of radioactive isotopes, possibly from Fukushima?
No, we don't. We don't have a way to do that. Some of the things that you may have seen recently are, I'd mentioned it a little bit earlier, common MERS that we got by the hundreds last year, dying on the beaches. And at the moment, we're getting in a sea duck called a surf scoter. And if you're out on the beaches these days, chances are good you've probably seen these guys. They're black. They've got a beautiful white spot on their head and a big orange bill. And we are getting these guys in, you know, 5-10 a day. And they we have actually, when an animal like this is coming in great numbers and dying, what we will do is necropsy them. And so, and the first several of these guys coming in, we realized that they had a parasite called a thorny head worm. And so we can try to figure out what's going on with them, but we don't have a way to check for any radioactive isotopes or anything like that. But that's a good point. I don't know what Fukushima has done to our oceans here as far as wildlife goes.
Also, I'm curious, do you think that possibly the severity of that incident coming up on 5 years ago, it's been underplayed, and do you think it should receive more media attention and exposure?
You know, quite honestly, that's not something I feel comfortable addressing. I just don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either.
Yeah, I think I think we're dealing primarily with a wildlife rescue organization, so that may be outside of their scope. But thanks for the question.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Okay,
thanks.
Okay, and let's see, we've got people have real serious questions about animals.
Yes,
that's good to see. This is probably more callers than we've had in quite some time. Okay, is it Marcel?
Yes.
Hi, Marcel. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to address one thing because you've had two callers now concerned about the cat issue. And I just thought it would be helpful because I think maybe people aren't really realizing the scope and numbers that we're talking about, because I think people are just thinking about their own cat. But in the large study that came out, I think 2 years ago, it was done by the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, and it brought in 21 different studies so that they would kind of have a statistical correct numbers. And they did the numbers in a range, you know, so that I know Claudia earlier mentioned that there were, you know, billions. We're talking in the billions. It was 1.4 to 3.7 billion birds and 6.9 to 20 billion mammals that cats kill each year. But it's not just our pets. It's mainly that there are these large, large outdoor cat colonies. And I remember in one of the study, there was one city, I believe it might have been Washington, D.C., that had over 300 cat colonies. And these are feral cats, and they're doing a fair amount of damage as well. It's not just our pets. And I think that it's important that we recognize that this is an annual number. It's 1.4 to 3.7 billion birds and 6.9 to 20 billion mammals. And maybe we just have too many cats living outside that are kind of gotten to invasive numbers. I just wanted to point
that out. Thanks for the point, and I suspect we could probably, if we wanted to have that as a separate topic on the program, we could be assured of having
a very lively
discussion.
But,
yeah.
You know, I didn't want the whole program to only be about, you know, most of the program to be about callers concerned about their pet cats, and I applaud people who try to reduce the number, because I have seen people feel really bad, you know, oh, every year my cat brings in 4, 5, 6, and they say that only one out of every four animals that your cat is catching are you actually aware of, so they really are having a great impact.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for doing the program.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I'm surprised that we got that many calls right away with regard to the cat issues, but I guess that's we can remember that if we ever feel like people aren't listening to the program and calling in, we'll bring up the topic of how your cat's being dealt with, and we'll make sure we get a lot of callers from that standpoint. We haven't spent much time, and I think it's important because of what we see. I remember a couple of oil spills in Alaska. I remember seeing film of the oil spill on the Gaviota Coast this last year, seeing basically ocean birds that I am, for lack of a better way, shocked that there's any way in the world that you could possibly get that bird to survive. But I guess they, I mean, how long a time do you spend, and you worked on that project, trying to save those birds from man-made, in this case, say, a pollutant, oil?
This is it's a particularly cogent topic for us because we just a week ago had a spill drill at our center with the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, which is a network. It's a state agency, and it's a network of wildlife rehabilitation centers up and down the coast that are trained. Personnel are trained, and equipment is kept ready in the case of an oil spill. And this was involved people from up and down the state. Pacific Wildlife Care is a primary care facility in the case of an oil spill. So what has happened is since we started having these large spills, there has been a tremendous amount of study done on how to care for these seabirds, and we've gotten actually very, very good at it. It's an arduous process to take these birds in and clean them and treat them and get them out again. And when we first started doing it, we weren't very good at it, but we've gotten very good. But it does take training, and we would encourage people, if you find an oiled bird, never, ever try to wash it or clean it. Get it to a wildlife facility, because you will, quite honestly, you will probably kill the bird. So it does, but both Virginia and I are on our wash team, so we're very involved in staying trained and keeping up with the latest methods of cleaning oiled birds.
It's a big mess. The videos I saw of it were just amazing, and I'm glad to hear you're successful with it. I was thinking, in most cases, you're just making these birds comfortable until they just die, because it just doesn't seem like you could get all of that off of them. But
actually, Pacific Wildlife Care gets oiled birds on a weekly basis because we have naturally occurring oil on our beaches.
Yeah.
And so we get oiled birds all the time, and we wash them all the time, and we successfully release many of them.
Yeah. Well, we've got a number of calls. I want to make sure we don't have callers we don't get to. And I guess in defense of the other side of the question for pets, we have a call from Mike with regard to lizards. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, well, this is first of all, I think what you people are doing is just excellent. I think it's great. I think the things that you're talking about in this program are wonderful. But lizards are ignored by people, sadly. And I'm a person that likes all different kinds of reptiles and amphibians also. And amphibians are struggling, of course, because of the ozone layer and everything else. But I'll tell you, any place that I've lived in where, especially residential areas, cats are amazing predators, and they will kill anything that moves if they have a chance. And whenever we move, it's a lizard-free zone, especially if people have cats around you. And there was one lady on one street that had probably 10 or 12 cats. And there were no birds, there were no lizards, there was nothing around. It was a lizard-free zone. And so I took it upon myself to put them in rock gardens and stuff. And then I went out and caught lizards from my daughter's winery and did all this kind of stuff and repopulated the area. Now we have lizards. But I'm constantly chasing cats out. And they just got death on those kinds of animals.
Yes, that's
Ernie.
True.
That may be more controversy than we want to get too deeply into, but thank you for the call, Mike.
Well, and I would like to add that we do take in reptiles, and we get a number of turtles and snakes and lizards, and we do rehab them, and we welcome them.
Yeah, the lizards live a very productive life in my house because there are dogs but no cats, and the lizards can outsmart any dog.
Too fast.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress. Okay, Kathy, you have some birdseed questions. You're on the air.
Okay, I would sometimes when I pick up my 20 pounds of birdseed, sometimes it seems like there is a white film, very light. Is that mildew? Is it bad for the birds? Should I take it back? Mostly, is it bad for the birds? And secondly, do you think it's mildew?
I don't know the answer. I think that's a good question for, like, Wild Birds Unlimited. I don't know the answer to that. Do you, Claudia?
I don't, but I would be concerned.
Yeah,
and if
I
it
would
is
too.
Mildew, I think you would want to return it. So I would take it back and certainly ask the whoever you purchased it from to look at it.
Yeah, it's the best answer we can give you, Kathy. Thanks for calling. Okay.
Good program.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, so, all right, you know, Ray, you're on the line, and I don't know if I trust this because the note says it's a short story. When I tell people it's a short story, they run away. But go ahead, jump on in here.
No, it's a short story. I'd like to share it with the listeners. I'm a surf fisherman, and I was on the beach all by myself, and all of a sudden, this pelican walked up to me, and he had fishing line and hooks all around him and into, you know, his body and everything. He came up to me, and I removed those hooks and the line, and he let me pat him on the head, and he flew away.
Yeah.
He looked for help. He looked for help. He came right up to me, you know?
Yep. Yeah. We see a lot of pelicans like that.
The animals are very... I mean, I think they're very smart. I love them. And, he knew he was in trouble, and he came to me.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. And you bring up a good point that we haven't talked about, and we just have a couple of minutes left. The discussion about how much plastic and how much debris is in our ocean that affects the wildlife, both in and out of the ocean, it's less common now to have those little plastic rings like they used to have on soda cans. And we get reminded by our proactive kids to always cut them up and turn them into little pieces because they end up in places that we are concerned about. So you see that all the time. You see animals, especially in the ocean or in the case of seabirds, that are... that have run into something they don't want to run into.
Yes,
we do.
Is that just a matter of extracting that and trying to nurse the bird back to positive health?
Yep, oftentimes, unless they've ingested something that we don't necessarily know about. We do have an X-ray, a digital X-ray machine, so we can look for things. A fishing line is the most common thing. Fishing line and fishing hooks and sinkers. We see on a lot of birds, especially pelicans, just like he was describing. But yes, we do see that quite a bit.
Yeah, and we would like, if people have find an animal with fish hooks or fish line, we would really like to see the animal because oftentimes this sounds like a great story, and it was wonderful that this gentleman was able to help this bird. If you find a bird with fish hooks, we would like to see it just in case the bird has swallowed a fish hook, and then we would treat it differently.
Okay, so that's you deal with things that those kind of things we would assume always being a problem, but I'm sure there's things that animals run into that we're not aware of.
Right, and sometimes it's a mystery for us, too. The animal can't say, oh, my stomach hurts, I have a headache, you know, this is what's going on with me. They come in, and you have to kind of solve a mystery of what's going on and why they've gotten here, and you take the information that the person who's brought the animal in can give you, where was it found, what was the situation, and try to piece together the puzzle and figure out what's happened.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure that we don't miss anything as we've drawn this discussion and gotten a lot of very good calls, so I want to give you each an opportunity for a little bit. What do you want to make sure we all remember about both the work you do and what we can do to be better stewards of our environment?
I'd like to say just a couple of quick things. One is we are a volunteer organization. We do rely on donations and membership, so we would encourage people to look at our website. We have a fundraiser coming up on April 10th. It's called Windows into Wildlife. It's in Paso Robles, and we'd love to have people come. We'll have our education animals there. Education is a big component of what we do. We have animal ambassadors that we can take and give talks about. So I would encourage people to support us. I think the work we do is really important. And when you need us, you'll be really glad that we're there. And the other thing I'd like to add is if you find a wild animal, please don't pet it and hold it and carry it. Put it in a dark, quiet place. These animals are under tremendous stress, and they may not act like they are, but they are. And so please... put them in a box, keep them dark and quiet, and get them to us as quickly as you can.
And the best way to find you is?
Call our hotline at 543-WILD or go to our website, pacificwildlifecare.org.
Okay, good.
And I think other thing I'd like to add, piggybacking on what Claudia said, is that we are volunteer for the most part, and we are always looking for volunteers. So if the idea of seeing wildlife kind of up close, even though it might be in a situation that's not ideal, but working with wildlife, working in a wildlife rehab facility is a fantastic experience, and we are always looking for volunteers. We do orientations the first Saturday of every month. They're an hour and a half, 10 to 11:30, and you can sign up on our website. And it's also just interesting to come in and get a little bit more of an idea of what actually happens at the center as far as animal care and so forth. And if you aren't interested in handling animals, there are a gazillion other jobs that we have that we need volunteers for, everything from office and admin work to answering phones and things like that. So we are always looking for people to help out.
And as I want to make sure we maybe cover this, people might assume that this is an incredibly burdensome job for the volunteers to do it, but people can commit as much time or as little time as they have available.
Yes.
And we ask for 4 hours every 2 weeks as a minimum commitment.
Okay, that's good to know, because that's not an outrageous demand, even though you have to deal with hundreds of animals every week.
And that's no, and you learn all sorts of wonderful things about wildlife.
Yeah, and in the notes I have from you also that there are organizations similar to yours. There's one in Santa Barbara County called Santa Barbara Wildlife Care,
mm-hmm.
so people can probably Google that and get information. And in Monterey County, I guess it's the SPCA, which is what we would think of more just for domestic animals.
Right.
But they're dealing with wildlife issues down there also. So so those are organizations available. And I guess in the case of the Santa Barbara oil spill, Santa Barbara Wildlife Care, I guess, was a lead agency on that. And you folks piggybacked on what they were doing?
Yeah, so they exactly. We got in some birds from their wildlife facility, because when that's happening in your home territory, all the animals that you have coming in normally, they have to go somewhere. So, you know, if you have hawks and other seabirds that you've got in your care, they the center is taken over, essentially, by the oiled birds coming in. So we got some birds from Santa Barbara Wildlife Care, and that's kind of, we okay. work as a network.
Yeah. And remind us again, how many animals did you deal with last year?
Almost exactly 3,000.
That's a tremendous burden, and I thank you very much for being part of what the community is doing to make that a positive experience.
Thanks.
For the wildlife around us, and that's great. This has been a great program. Anybody who thought talking about dealing with wild animals and their rescue would not be a lively program was we've talked for an hour, and I'm glad we were able to do that. I want to remind people this is Central Coast Voices, and we're a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Want to let you know, remind you that I alternate weeks with Chris Kington Barker, and she'll be here next week. After the passage of the California Senate Bill 277 last year, mandating childhood immunizations, many parents have become concerned about that from a safety issue. Next week, Chris will be talking to Dr. Gary Forsman and Jessica Joslin, who's a physician's assistant there with MidPath Medicine, and they'll talk about approaches for people dealing with integrative medicine and how their office addresses the concerns of parents with regard to immunization issues. Central Coast Voices, as I said before, is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX. Thank you to Joan Gillard Sargent, who underwrites this program. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. Thank you to KCBX. Thank you to all the listeners of KCBX. And thank you to my guests today, Claudia Duxworth and Virginia Flaherty. It's been a great, it's been a great program, and I'm glad you could be part of it today.
Thank you. Thank you.